I am in the unusual position of moderating myself for this discussion. Having been moved from the morning's historical session into this one. And this makes perfect sense because the other speakers with whom I'm sharing this panel are in fact presenting a very initial version of the software project that I'll be describing from an historical perspective. And this is also something I find a little embarrassing to have a sort of microcosm sponsor session in the midst of the conference, but I hope you'll bear with me. Now, what I want to talk about today is yet another example of what we might, whether problematically or not, call historical information technology. And in fact, I'll happily use some of the reverse metaphors here and describe what I'm about to describe to you, in fact, as an early form of graphical user interface. What I'm talking about is the concept of the 16th century memory theater. And as I see it, the memory theater that Giulio Camillo created around 1530 was designed in part as a response to a information overload problem in the period. And we can think of the 16th century as having its own unique set of quantitative and qualitative shifts in the nature of the information world. And some of these things are very familiar to us with the emergence of inexpensive paper and the conjunction of that with the invention of movable type. We have the emergence of print culture, which has one of the immediate effects of radically increasing the bandwidth of information in the period, again, to sort of reverse engineer my metaphors. One of the other things that happens is with the Portuguese improvements on the astrolabe, their invention of the square-rigged sail, Europeans begin to travel much more widely in the world, making extensive trade and travel contacts with Africa, with India, and of course eventually with the New World. And one of the results of this is really a disruptively expanding sense of the world in the period. Humanism itself is, in essence, a kind of information problem. The revival of classical learning, but particularly with the idea that one had to understand it from an historical perspective, that one could not take for granted what the ancients had to say, but one needed to archaeologically reconstruct this, led to the creation of new kinds of disciplines, the disciplines of archaeology, of philology, of etymology and such. And this also produces a new wealth of information that people have to deal with. And lastly, there's a quality, a sort of mode of literary and artistic production in the period, which understood the creative process and the process of producing new and original pieces of writing or new and original pieces of art and so forth as actually a process of going back to sources, going back to origins. And one finds over and over and over again in the period a comparison of a piece of writing or of a painting or of even an oral presentation, an oration, as a kind of mosaic or a tapestry, as a weaving together of different strands of received knowledge into new and scintillating patterns. Something which has always struck me as very, very similar to the glass bead game that Hermann Hesse describes in Magister Ludi. In order to cope with this vast amount of information and the qualitative change in the nature of the knowledge that's produced out of it, new ways had to be found of storing, accessing, and reactivating knowledge. And what seems to have happened is that people in the 16th century, in fact, turned back themselves to older information technologies. And in fact, to the information technology that Christian Jacot introduced in his paper, which is that of rhetorical memory systems, which may be familiar here to a number of you. The idea of an artificial memory dates back at least to ancient Greece, and its invention as a way of not merely remembering what you have to know, but actually of organizing, storing, and activating that knowledge so that it can be productively deployed in unforeseen future instances in social circumstances. So that there is the creation of a mental information technology, which is actually a quite formidable one, as again Christian Jacot described in relation to the Alexandria Digital Library with his instance of living libraries among the scholars there. This idea of knowledge being stored mentally in places is very crucial. The idea that knowledge is actually located somewhere, that one finds it by moving from place to place, is one of the fundamental characteristics of this. And one of the manifestations of it that is most familiar to people is the concept of the memory palace, where one is to create in your mind and imagine architectural space with many rooms, and as you need to remember things, as for instance you might be coming to a conference to present a speech and you wish to do it extemporaneously, you enter a room of your palace, and in it you place emblems and statues and significant images that are mnemonic cues to certain parts of what you need to present, and you move from room to room, placing elements of your full oration within that space. Then at this later point, when you need to recall this, as you're speaking, you imagine yourself actually walking through the space and encountering object after object in sequence. And it triggers the proper memories, and you can speak with the facility of Cicero about whatever topic you might need. Not being blessed with a good natural memory, I actually still rely on writing. By the time we get up to the 16th century, this is something that is very well established in Roman rhetoric and continues on through medieval rhetorical systems. But when it gets to the 16th century, there is a change in the way these kind of memory systems are understood and the way in which they're used. And one of its results is that these kinds of purely abstract mental conceptions become physically manifest in the world. We're familiar, for instance, with the notion of a commonplace book. Continues to this day in something like Bartlett's Book of Familiar Quotations. But in fact, the commonplace book is itself a material instantiation of these kinds of mental memory theaters, in which each page of the book, each topic and subtopic is understood as a place in which information can be placed in what I call a partially activated state, so that there are markers within the book to indicate what kind of knowledge is there. The presence of citations together on the page suggests certain kinds of resonances and dissonances among the material that actually stimulate your response to the material as well. It does not lie completely inert, but neither is the commonplace book a fully activated kind of knowledge. It is not a statement in itself, but is the potential for making any and all statements. We can find very similar kinds of structures in many other places in the 16th century. In the curiosity cabinet, these very heterogeneous collections of both natural and artificial materials, increasingly evidence is coming to light that they were physically as well as conceptually ordered according to commonplaces, according to a kind of memory system. In my own work as an art historian, I have made similar similar kinds of arguments that you can find this sort of a system at work actually in individual paintings. But what I want to talk about today is a particular form of the memory palace, which is called the memory theater. There were alternative kinds of architectural spaces that you could use. And in particular, to a memory theater that was built by an Italian humanist named Giulio Camillo. His name is C-A-M-I-L-L-O. Who built this structure for the King of France around the year 1530. This was then a physical building that one could enter into. And it still worked, though, as a version of these kinds of mental memory theaters. Camillo himself describes what he is building as a mind with windows, is one of the metaphors that of the many that he uses for this, as actually a mind that one can walk into and, as it were, peer through various windows at the storehouse of knowledge that is contained within it. And it's meant as a kind of two-way flow, that one assembles vast amounts of information, in fact, of sort of activated information, of knowledge within it, and you enter and you sort of absorb this knowledge in, and then you're transformed in the process. And this actually strikes me as something analogous to what Cliff Siskin was talking about in terms of augmentation and improvement, that the visitor to the memory theater, in fact, is transformed by the process. And can, after working within the system, discourse, and again, the exact phrase that Camillo uses is discourse with the facility of Cicero about any possible topic. So the memory theater is actually meant to serve as a kind of interface to a potentially infinite amount of information, to all possible knowledge about all possible things. Now, Camillo built a model of this theater, which has long since been lost, but he also wrote a treatise about it, and there were, Camillo actually turns out to be one of the most famous people in the 16th century, although he also generally seems to be regarded as something of a hack, but someone who was intensely talked about, and so we have a very clear notion of what the theater was. He never built the final version. He was working for the King of France, some wit at the time noted that the theater did not work well enough to be able to remind Francis I to pay him the money he needed for completing the theater. What I'm talking about here is the sort of historical and conceptual underpinnings of a software project that we're launching within Microcosm. So in a certain sense, what we're hoping to do is to complete the work that that Camillo began and hopefully not do it as hacks ourselves. But what I would now like to do, if we can switch to the slide projector, and I think I can... and I apologize, it is impossible for you to read, but at least you have a pictorial indication of what the theater looked like in schematic terms. What Camillo built was a physical amphitheater, and in the place where normally you would expect spectators to be located, he placed seven tiers of seven what are described as gates. Each of the gates fitted out with containers to hold texts and objects related to particular fields of knowledge. And the user of the system would enter in where normally the performers would stand in an amphitheater, and there would imbibe the knowledge that is contained within it, and then at a certain moment switch roles and actually become a performer on stage, and since this is a King of France, on stage himself. what is significant about this is the way in which this actually serves as a means of structuring what is a vast and heterogeneous body of material. And what Camillo does is he lays this out in a matrix, a 7x7 matrix with two axes. And this is clothed in hermetical and Kabbalistic language, and so at the base of each of the columns you see is located a one of each of seven Zephyroths, pure eminences and essences of the universe, that then are, as you move up, turn into each of the seven planets, and then move to different elements, and so forth through the system, so that this is actually a cosmological map that he presents. But at the same time, he locates particular fields of knowledge in relation to each of these essences, each of these planetary deities. So each of the columns, in fact, represents a different realm of knowledge. So for instance, Jupiter represents the element of air. And as you move up the system, you move through all the manifestations of air as an element, both conceptually and materially, until up at the highest level. You reach its physical deployment in the world, and there is material related to the construction, for instance, of windmills up at the highest level. And this gives also some indication of what the second axis in the system is. If each of the columns represents different fields of knowledge, each of the horizontal rows in Camillo's description represents stages in the conceptual creation of the universe. But effectively, what he offers is a movement from abstract to empirical knowledge, from idealized Platonic forms of knowledge to their physical deployment and employment in the world. Now, both of these axes are indicated by images. Each of the planetary deities is given its astrological symbol, which is marked over each gate. And each of the horizontal rows is marked, in fact, by a narrative emblematic scene taken from classical literature and classical mythology. So you have, for instance, the Homeric banquet that Ocean offered to the gods, that Oceanus offered to the gods, is the scene that would be depicted on each of the places in the lowest level of the theater. And the next up is again taken from Homer, his idea of the Cave of the Nymphs, and Camillo is very explicit that this is not the Platonic cave he's talking about, and we move on to Hesiod and the three Gorgon sisters, and so on up to the top level, where we have Prometheus, who, as you remember, stole fire from the gods and brought it to humanity, in essence beginning human technological culture, and that is the level at which, again, deployment in the world takes place. Now, what becomes interesting about the system is not simply that it's a 7x7 matrix, but that there is a third set of images attached to each place in the theater as well. And these actually are shared almost randomly, it would appear, across the system. So there are other iconic scenes located on each place that one can find at various places in the theater. And these serve as a kind of cross-referencing, or in fact a third axis, that allows Camillo to make associative links among the material within the theater. And it's by a combination of observing and navigating through these various icons that one can efficiently locate whatever information one needs to know, but one also derives a considerable amount of information about their context at the same time. So in this system, proximity is important, location is important. Where a particular kind of object, a particular kind of document, a particular image is located, itself tells you a considerable amount about what that material is and what other kinds of materials may be related to it. And so the user of this system moves through it in a highly associative manner. You enter in and you begin with a particular kind of information you're interested in, and then by seeing what is located close to it in one of the three axes, you can begin exploring other aspects of that particular body of knowledge. One can be led to other fields, to other forms of instantiation, and so forth. So that, again, what the viewer does in entering into this theater is, in fact, to activate the material that, again, lies partially dormant within it. And it's this process of activation, the use of the system, that allows it to be used in creating new knowledge. So for our current project, we're interested in certain aspects of what this theater does, and one of them is that it is transformative. And again, I'm reminded of what Clifford Siskin was discussing in terms of augmentation, that it is meant, in fact, not just as to be a model of mind, but something that itself structures the user's mind, so that someone versed in the system, and I think we can make the same argument about those who are trained in commonplace systems, actually begin to perceive the world and apprehend it according to the logic of this particular kind of spatial system. That the system exists theoretically to provide an interface to potentially infinite amounts of extremely heterogeneous data, which is, again, a particular kind of knowledge problem that we as scholars are faced with today as we grapple with demands of increasingly interdisciplinary kinds of work. That it works according to a process of association, that memory in particular is seen as a key to activating knowledge within the system, that memory is in fact the place in which creative activity is understood to take place within a system like this. That knowledge objects within the system can be located in multiple places at the same time. And this also becomes clear from Camilla's description of the theater, that certain kinds of texts are located in multiple places throughout the theater or can be identified by multiple instances of particular images. And so the binding to place is, in fact, it's not so much of a binding as a kind of activation of a fluid system. That what we're talking about here is not the categorical delimitation of what particular kinds of knowledge objects are, but simply topical descriptions of certain features of them. And this, in turn, allows a particular kind of fluidity in joining kinds of information together. And lastly, to reiterate, that location in this system is meaningful, that proximity and distance tell you considerable amounts about the kind of information contained within it. So the current project that we're engaged in, and which Philip Salas and Brendan Dobbs will be presenting a sort of first stab, first version of the software we're hoping to design, is meant to be a recuperation of historical information technology, a recuperation, in fact, of a particular kind of interface for a digital research environment. We hope in doing this to be able to retain the associative qualities of a memory system, create a system in which it both allows for the unique necessary ordering needs of the particular individual who uses the system, as well as set up something which allows a fluid and productive interchange of information with others who participate within the same kind of system. that we are interested in creating something which in fact establishes the theater as a metaphor within the computer to facilitate one's own access to the complex amounts of data on a computer, but also create meta-theaters, which are interlinkings of various kinds or various other theaters belonging to scholars within the system. In terms of the structure of information within this, although I referred to the third set of images as a third axis in this, I think this is actually misleading. I'd like to borrow a term actually from Jeremy Douglas that Bill Warner introduced, our technological whiz for putting on this conference, concept of radical flatness in terms of the ordering of data within the kind of system we're talking about. And the nearest thing I can do is to describe to you is to equate it to the kind of scaling effect that we're familiar with from fractal depictions, that at whatever scale of resolution you look, there is an equivalent degree of complexity within the system. What we're talking about is creating theaters that can in fact have theaters embedded within them, all of which though in terms of the data structure reside within a planar surface, which allows a much greater facility in terms of interlinking material to each other.